Good afternoon. My name is Patrick Brenner. I am the founder and president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us this afternoon as we partake in another episode of SPP Live TV. I'm joined today by our chairman of the board of directors, Mr. Brett Coconatis. Brett and I were just at the American Financial Services Association Independence Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada last week. A little background on this. This is specifically pertaining to the interest rate cap issue that is presently facing New Mexico and causing a liquidity crisis for consumers across the state. In January, the interest rate cap went into effect, capping the interest rate for loans at 36%. Shortly thereafter, Pew Charitable Trusts, based in Philadelphia, released a report identifying that six of the largest eight banks in the country were offering specialized emergency loans now that a vacuum had taken place and there were no loan providers available to provide these loans, specifically in states like New Mexico. Three of those six banks had branches in New Mexico: U.S. Bank, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. We sought to conduct a study, an experiment, a shoe leather reporting, undercover journalism type experiment, a secret shopper experiment, as you will, and actually apply for the loans at these three banking institutions. Needless to say, the Institute found that the banks were not actually lending money because of these strict criteria associated with the loans themselves. They required that a borrower had an existing relationship with the bank, that the checking account existed for the borrower with the bank in question, and that checking account had recurring direct deposits and a history of at least 6 to 12 months, depending on the bank itself. We applied for loans at all the institutions, and we were declined at all the institutions. I personally applied myself, and I have a credit score in excess of 750 at the time, and we just sought to determine whether or not Pew Charitable Trust was right in calling out the six of the eight largest banks in the United States for offering these lending products. Shortly thereafter, we published a companion piece in American Banker that appeared late in March, and the American Financial Services Association picked up on the companion piece in American Banker and invited us to present our findings at their annual conference in Las Vegas, Nevada last week.
Patrick, let me interrupt real quick. So can we put up the report on the screen?
Yeah, you bet.
Let's show it. So I wanted to touch on a couple key things that we learned in about this market. So first off, for those that are joining us, thank you. And the important thing to recognize is that New Mexico, in this particular case, is not unique. One of the things that I think Patrick will talk about later is what we've heard about the industry experts talking in regards to about this legislation that's being pushed at the state level. And it's referred to as the Military Lending Act. This is the precedent used for the new credit legislation that's being pushed throughout. One important thing to point out, though, is that New Mexico, 50% of our citizens are on some kind of government assistance. This kind of makes up a demographic within the space, which is not, again, unique to this state, but all states. There is a customer that exists that depends on non-traditional lending. And what we mean by that, go ahead, Patrick, I'm sorry.
A huge portion of Albuquerque residents, relatively speaking, are considered unbanked or underbanked. And that's an outlier from other states across the country. We have a much larger portion of citizens in the state that are considered unbanked or underbanked.
Right. And given, you know, the time that this legislation was introduced, everybody, not just New Mexico, but the entire world was going through economic challenges from COVID recoveries and still suffering under COVID emergency orders. So this further injured citizens that needed access to emergency cash, especially in these economic times that we're facing increasing costs of, you know, supply chain items, grocery items, living expenses, unexpected repair bills, things of this nature. So we did understand that, you know, of course, this market was charging a fee in New Mexico of up to 175%. And I think, you know, anyone who's not familiar with this industry immediately says, yeah, of course there was room to improve on that, right? That's the immediate response rate. We see, you know, mortgages at a different rate. We see credit cards at a different rate. But what we're not understanding is that these are installment loans. These are not long-term credit card loans. So if your credit card was at 365%, of course, everyone would be concerned. If it was at 175%, you'd probably cancel your credit card. But one of the analogies that was used is that these loans are meant for short-term emergency use. And if we took out a $100 loan and we paid back $101 tomorrow, effectively that interest rate's at 365%, even though we were only charged $1 interest. So we saw this, you know, for the people who aren't in this space, which I was not in the financial space. We service the financial space in our professional lives, in business, in some capacities, but we don't deal with the mortgage industry. We don't deal with short-term loan industries. We don't deal with payday loans, things like that. Of course, what we see is the Democrat arm, and I think even some conservatives are concerned about protecting constituents. And particularly, that's where the MLA started, was they felt that this was a national security issue for the military. So they capped the loans at 36%, because if the military was exposed to high interest loans, chances are they are obtaining those loans from unregulated sources, untrustworthy sources potentially. And that further jeopardized national security. That law, the MLA, was amended in 2012. And that is kind of the model that was intended for the Department of Defense to protect our service members. And that's now being applied, you know, state by state, that's affecting that industry. New Mexico being one of the test grounds for that, an example. Am I right? Am I summarizing that right, Patrick? Have we learned, is that?
I think that's as good a summary as anyone could ever come up with. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, good. So at least I know I paid attention there, right? So going back to our report here, the No Loan for You program, I mean, you know, this was something that you worked on with other members at SPPI. I remember the report coming out and how much attention we immediately got from this finding, because initially, like you said, you know, people see this, they say, well, I can go to the bank. I can go to my local community credit union. And in New Mexico, if I'm a state employee, apparently I can even go to the state now and, you know, take an advance on my payroll. Is that right? I think I saw that in this last session. The state wants to become a bank here.
That kind of stuff makes me want to pull my hair out, Brett.
Right. So everyone in this industry says that they're able to serve the customer. And what you saw in this report that we released from your efforts was that what industry is telling us is simply not true.
Yes. We applied at U.S. Bank, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. I had to physically go into each of those branches in order to open a checking account, because a criteria for the lending of these specialized emergency loans was that I had to have an open checking account so that I could have access to online banking. Mm-hmm. I could not actually apply for the loan itself within the branch. I had to apply for the loan online.
So if you were a customer, a legitimate customer that was in need of emergency access to liquidity, cash, you walked into your local bank, you talked to a loan officer, to a teller, and you said, hi, I'm here for a personal short-term loan?
Yes.
Okay. So they sat you down, they said, are you a current customer with the bank? And of course you said you weren't. So they opened up a checking account. They made you open up a checking account before they would even take your application for a loan.
Right. Once the checking account was open, which required a $25 minimum deposit at the three branches that we attempted to get these loans from. So I'm already out $75 in capital.
Because you tried to apply at three different banks.
Correct. Yes. Okay.
So you had to put in a minimum deposit. You had to open. How long did it take you to open up the checking account?
Less than an hour.
Okay.
Probably once I was in the branch and once I had... understand that when I went to U.S. Bank, that was my first attempt was U.S. Bank, walk into the branch, try to open a checking account, neglected to walk in with cash. So I had to go find an ATM and withdraw cash. I withdrew the amount for the rest of the branches, but all of that included, it probably took me about 45 minutes to apply for a checking account at U.S. Bank, to get to the branch, get the cash, and apply for the checking account, and then walk out of the branch with my new checking account and access to online banking at U.S. Bank. Now, once I had the checking account open and online banking established, applying for the simple loan, as it's called from US Bank, was relatively straightforward and easy. It was easy to find the product in their list of products online.
Okay.
And being declined was equally easy.
So out of the three banks you walked into, that you did all three banks in one day?
No, I did it over the course of a week.
Okay, so over the course of a week, you applied at three different banks. You got three different hits to your credit. Was that, did that affect your credit score at all?
Actually, no. These three banks did not run a hard inquiry on my against my credit report, which is why they use this alternate lending criteria. They have the open checking account requirement to see your transactional history and ensure that you're not overdrafting your account too regularly or at all. I mean, you're looking right here at the extent of what I'm provided as a consumer. The reason that we were declared ineligible is I was not the owner of an open US Bank checking account, which this was just caused by a delay. I applied again the next day after the checking account had actually solidified in their online banking experience, but it was impossible for a same day application. What else? US Bank checking account open less than 6 months. Bank of America requires a 12-month minimum. Insufficient number of recurring direct deposits, and no U.S. bank checking account eligible for deposits, obviously referring to the not the owner of a U.S. bank checking account. So those are the lending criteria. And
okay, did they ask you like how much you were applying for or what you were going to use the funds for?
Nope.
No. So this was just to see if you qualified.
Yes.
Okay. So I mean,
probably conduct another experiment right now and see if we're still ineligible while we're live.
That would be interesting. One of the things though here is, you know, a big contrast and difference. When I'm thinking about this segment of the market and the businesses that service this sector, it's really about a matter of convenience and emergency, right? When I think about people in this situation, it's because you have a mechanical problem and you need to get to work, or you have a vet visit, you know, an unexpected vet visit because of a pet emergency, or you have, you know, a quick run-in, maybe, you know, a fender bender or something like that. These are situations where they're unplanned expenses. You need to be able to get in and get out and resolve the situation quickly. We've all been there. We've all been in these circumstances. You get a flat tire, you have to buy a new tire. You don't have access to the money. What do we do? Well, because we fit into the banking category, we have access to a line of credit in the form of a credit card, right? But some of these customers, they don't have that accessibility. And when we start talking about the dialogue that's happening in the political space, not just in the financial space, but all things, we talk about equality. Well, instead of about equality, let's talk about equity, right? And making sure that solutions are accessible. We don't need the government to come in and tell us what is safe and what is not safe financially for consumers. I mean, we see this happening across the board at many levels. Okay. We saw this happening now in the crypto trading space, where we have issues with the Securities Exchange Commission, which the United States is in a unique position, and they're trying to tell us how to keep consumers safe, where in essence, they're actually keeping consumers out of an opportunity. So the government is not here to help in all regards. And I think that's where we started to talk out maybe a little bit out of timeline here, but about the Military Lending Act. I mean, I think at the surface level, industry members, trade organizations, everybody is going to agree that, you know, protecting our service members is the right thing to do. I think everyone's going to agree that protecting national security is the right thing to do. And when we look at the percentage of applicants that are service members, that is a small percentage of affected customers. And I think organizations that are servicing this client base, they're willing to take that loss of revenue and service our members to give back. But when we look at taking those same concerns, I mean, Patrick, you know, we're working in this institute. I don't think either of us, you know, entering into a loan of our choosing is a national security risk.
I think you're right.
Right. I don't think if I need to go take a second mortgage, or if I need to go finance my car, or if I need to go get an emergency installment loan, I don't think that's a national security risk.
Well, I would actually hazard a guess that it's a national security risk for you to not be able to access that type of equity. What if you can't get to work?
Right. Well, I mean, look at New Mexico. Okay. When we have a state that has been hit as hard as it has with these economic factors, when we have half of our state that is dependent on some kind of government assistance, whether that be SNAP or income supplement or housing assistance or something of that nature, why is it that we're making it more difficult for citizens to do the responsible thing financially, get an installment loan, establish a credit rating, establish a good history, and become a traditional banking customer? What has happened with, you know, these quote unquote good intentions of legislators is we have created a liquidity desert. And when consumers are in a position of crisis, they are going to be left with very limited options. And that might mean turning to unregulated lending sources. That might mean turning to illicit activities. That might mean just plain out larceny and theft or going without. And I think that is a concern that legislators need to be considering when they're looking at these blanket policies that are capping rate caps. I mean, there's plenty of studies, Patrick, and I think you'll probably be able to point to some more references, but I'm sure there's been studies about the effectiveness of rate caps, right?
That they're not effective. Yes.
Yeah. So we've seen that, you know, time and time again, that capping these rate limits not only hurt industry, but it hurt the consumer. You know, thankfully, this is something that's happening at the state level. And hopefully states are going to see the negative effects. I know we've already seen the negative effects here in New Mexico. How many of our short-term lenders have left the state? How many did we have? Do you know exactly, Patrick?
There were around 400. We mentioned the specific number somewhere in the report itself. I think I can find it really quick. Just give me a second. Yes. So from 452 in June were lending, that reduced to 418 lenders by November. So we saw a reduction of 7.5% in the number of small licensed small loan companies in New Mexico.
And what was that? That was a matter of 5 months?
Yes. Yes.
So we can only imagine, you know, that that number is going to continue to reduce in the state as more and more liquidity providers, short-term loan providers, are no longer able to sustain their operations. You know, and I think this is important because, you know, when people are out there and they talk about that rate cap, especially in New Mexico, that perception of APR, and when people say, oh, well, it's 175%, how come they're not making money? How can they not survive? How come they can't survive at 36%. Well, let's look at all the factors. Okay, we have to consider the cost of the facilities of running a storefront. We have to consider the advertising to reach the customer. We have to consider that a percentage of the customers that apply, we may not be able to service for some reason. The other option is going to be the default rate. How hard does the lender have to work to, you know, to be made whole and to ensure that those payments are made timely and completely? And how many of those customers that are traditionally unserviceable or unbankable by traditional lending providers in the community, how many of those are going to default? How much money is going to be lost by that lender? And how do they recuperate that cost to continue to service the community?
You're hitting on some really important points. One is that these borrowers are borrowing from non-traditional financial institutions for a reason. Now, whether that's a direct choice of the consumer and choosing to utilize the services of a non-traditional banking institution or a non-traditional financial institution by choice, or whether it's because they've been forced into a situation where they do not have a choice. They cannot acquire credit from a traditional banking institution. They're there. They are at one of these specialized emergency lenders. They don't have a choice, or they do have a choice and they've chosen to utilize the services of a specialized emergency lender in lieu of anything else. Why are we now suddenly declaring as a state with our state policy, why are we declaring that either because of that choice or because they've been forced into that position by their credit history or lack of credit history, they're not allowed to borrow money anymore?
Right.
That's essentially what's happened here, is you've got a state that has created policy that has declared that borrowers are not allowed to borrow money.
Well, it's not allowed to borrow money, but essentially they have become non-credit worthy.
Right.
Statute. You know, and I think that was an unintended consequence. I mean, I really think that everyone involved is really trying to do the right thing. You know, but again, you know, when you're not looking at the actual details and you're just going at surface level, 175% APR, you know, we just said, if you took out a loan for $100 and you paid that loan back tomorrow with $1 interest paid in at $101, it's 365%.
Right.
So, you know, $1, it doesn't seem as drastic as 365%. Of course, that's just an example. But you can extrapolate that over. We're not borrowing $500 for 30 years.
Right. We are borrowing $500 for anywhere between 4 to 6 months. And now that we're on that subject, I mean, let's talk about the actual types of loans that these people are borrowing. I mean, we're talking about loans that have a duration of less than a year on average from one of our from an industry participant whom we've spoken with at length about the types of products that they offer. They have declared to us that their average duration of their loans is 111 days. That is less than 4 months. That is less than a third of a year.
Yeah.
Yet so, still, they're obligated by certain regulatory institutions to report their interest rates using APR. They're having to annualize a loan that is not annualized. You're borrowing money for less than a year, yet you're being forced by a regulatory institution to apply a 365-day percent rate on it instead of a percent rate that's more appropriate, or incorporating something that's like a reporting on the flat fees associated with it, or declaring that this is a flat fee. They can't do that. It's illegal for a borrower to report their interest rate as a flat fee. They have to report it as an APR.
Right. So what you're saying is that the MLA, as it is written, is called all in, interest all in, right? So this is all inclusive. So this means that, let's say, if a lender has a, let's just say, credit check fee. Let's say they charge you $25 for a credit check fee. That $25 must be added to the loan amount,
right,
or the interest amount that would be total paid. And then it's reversed out to calculate the new interest APR based upon their math.
Yes.
So that $25 is now included in that 36%.
Correct.
Right. So if you had, let's say, if you had some kind of unemployment insurance on your loan, you lose your job, you become disabled. That's a pretty common service that's on even your credit card, you know, that you can add for $12 a month or whatever. You know, they'll cover your minimum payment for up to a year if you get disabled. Those types of services, those ancillary services that are chosen by the consumer, are actually add to that 36% total. So in essence,
the
lender has to charge less interest, even less interest, true interest, to remain under that 36%.
Right.
If a customer adds another product.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess you could say some lenders might use that as a revenue source, but I think it's really, again, not really covered well in the MLA in this particular use case, when the MLA is being applied to a consumer market because those are fees that are not prescriptive by the lender. Those are options usually that are chosen by the consumer, and it's affecting regulatory limits imposed by the state government. So it doesn't seem like it's the right thing to do, I guess, if we're trying to be fair to everybody.
It doesn't. But,
you know,
let's take that and let's apply it to the hotel industry.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
We stayed in a hotel for two nights, mm-hmm. and if we were up to apply an APR type rate to those hotel rooms, you're looking at spending $36,000 a year.
Right. Yeah. Night. So you don't see, like, on booking.com or whatever, you don't see your hotel marketed at $36,000 a year, do you?
I don't.
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
they usually give you a nightly price, right?
Right, right. But these specialized emergency lenders are forced to disclose their rate as though it were annualized for a loan that isn't being borrowed for more than 4 months.
Yeah, I mean, just off the cuff. And again, I'm not an industry expert. We're learning from our friends and, you know, from the consumer, particularly the ones that we've interacted with, too. It's interesting, though, because, you know, when we went to these events, obviously, when you go to these trade shows, you're kind of expecting a little bit of a skew. You know, you're expecting the industry to be very defensive of their position and protecting their people. And what was interesting for me is even talking to some of the folks in these organizations was it wasn't about party politics. You know, I talked to a lot of people that openly identified as conservatives, and, you know, they take the free market approach. And then I talked to other people, I think you did too, that identified as, you know, ultra progressive liberals, Democrats. Supporters that were on that spectrum, and they were equally as concerned about this issue because they were in this space. They saw what it was doing to their community, to these people who depend on these services. I mean, where else do you go if you are looking to develop your credit and become a traditional banking customer?
Right. Well, according to Pew, you can go to one of these three banks in New Mexico and get denied.
Yeah.
And that's one of the most lacking things in this industry space is the ability for these industry participants and consumers to tell their narrative, to tell their story. And that's why our work here on the No Loan for You project was really hit a home run. We were able to tell the shoe leather reporting narrative of we mimicked a consumer experience. We emulated a consumer experience, and that's not.
Let's be honest, okay? When we're having public testimony, right, and you're having legislators bring in their experts and bring in their community witnesses and give public statement, you know, I think there is a certain level of pride, maybe a little bit of privacy, maybe a little bit of embarrassment, where customers aren't going to want to give public testimony about their financial condition, right? I mean, if you're someone that's going out, Patrick, like you are, you're talking about your denial, but you're a well-qualified borrower.
Right. I think at the time I applied for these loans, I had a credit score in excess of 750. And my wife and I carry a mortgage. We already have a car payment and we make our payments on time. I'm by all lending criteria, I'm a well-qualified borrower. My debt to income ratio isn't through the roof. I'm a well-qualified borrower, and I still couldn't get one of these loans.
But what I'm saying is for you to come forward and, you know, give your testimony on your experience today online in the report, I don't think you have any embarrassment. Right. You're doing this to prove a point. But for a consumer that has no choice but to go into this market to access to liquidity, I think they're going to be a little hesitant to come forward and talk about their experience. One, because, again, that's a private matter. I don't think people want to talk about their inability to access liquidity. I don't think people want to talk about their hardships in a public comment form. It's just, it's not the proper setting. And I think that that's really the issue, right? The pro MLA agenda folks can come up there and talk about their perception of why this industry is not doing the community a service and needs more harsh regulations, to the point of where they're basically putting this industry out of existence in some states. And then to come to the aid of that, you have to have folks that are willing to sacrifice some pride and maybe share some personal information in a public format where, you know, that's a pretty hard ask.
Right. Right. And unless it's part of an academic study.
Right.
Which,
so I think that's why this report, you know, and I encourage people that, you know, are streaming today or watching this recorded, go to our website at southwestpolicy.com or Google the No Loan for You report. There's a short URL below that will take you right to the study and give you more detail about the process that Patrick and the Institute has gone through to conduct the study. And Patrick, I believe that we have a forthcoming study to follow on to this. Is that right?
Correct. So as part of this original study, No Loan for You, we released a companion article that was published by American Banker, and that was at the end of last month. That was, let's see if I can pull up a copy of that really quick. Right. So we were featured in under the consumer banking category on American Banker, and this really distilled our findings from the No Loan for You report into something that was appropriate for a trade publication. And that's what drew attention to the Institute from the American Financial Services Association. But our next step is to take a look at these loans from the big banks, the six big banks, in other states. And right now we're working with two students with the University of Minnesota. They have gone out and they have applied for these loans. We were able to add on one additional bank. This was Huntington Bank. They offer a specialized emergency loan product. We asked the two students to duplicate our application process. They have to go to U.S. Bank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and now Huntington Bank, open a checking account, and then conduct the same application for these specialized emergency loan products that we did. And then we're going to compile their narrative into a second iteration of our report and release that in the coming weeks. As a continuation of that, we need to go out and find if these loans even exist at the credit unions too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it's really important, Patrick, and I think the Institute, you know, under your leadership and everything that the board and participants are working on in our organization, I know a lot of people do stuff around the clock here. But what's really important is that I don't think we're not advocating for any specific change at this point. We're not taking a position on the issue as far as what the interest rate should be or, you know, what the process should be in legislation. I think what the most important work that we're doing for industry, for the people of New Mexico, for the people of the United States that are in these states where rate caps are being pushed in state legislatures, is the fact that the Institute is here sharing the stories, those hardship stories we just talked about, those embarrassing stories that are difficult for people to come forward and share, whether that's on a Zoom meeting or whether that's in a public hearing or in public testimony. This is embarrassing. I mean, it's one thing if you have, you know, $100,000 in the bank and you want to go and you want to talk about, you know, how hard it is to get a mortgage. It's another thing when you're trying to go out and make ends meet or get your car fixed and you're already working two or three jobs and you're trying to just make it through this crisis. That, I think, is what the Institute is really trying to highlight and to help, is the people who don't have a voice in this process and that are fighting, you know, the aggressive policies of political agendas and trying to, you know, hold on to a lifeline.
We're advocating on behalf of consumers, Brett, and we're empowering these consumers to come forward and tell their stories about how these specialized emergency loan products have helped them out of tricky financial situations. We're out there empowering these consumers to come forward and tell their success stories, but we're also empowering consumers to come forward and tell the stories, the horror stories now that they don't have access to this specialized type of liquidity.
Yeah. So I, you know, Patrick, I just want to say thank you for the work that you're doing and everyone at the Institute that's doing for the people in New Mexico. Yeah, I think this is great. You know, like I said, it's real easy to take the other side of the conversation and say, yeah, rate caps are a good thing. But in reality, when you start talking to the people who that affects on a daily basis, not the politicians trying to get a headline, not the politicians that are trying to get reelected, but the people where the laws are actually affecting folks, their quality of life, the conversations at dinner table, how they're going to get to work. Those are the people that really matter. And that's where politicians should be focusing their considerations when making suggestions or introducing legislation.
Thank you for putting that so eloquently. I couldn't have done better myself.
Thanks, Patrick. Yep.
Well, folks, we're going to cut this one short. Thank you so much for tuning in today to our live stream at SPPI TV. I hope you'll tune in to our channel next week, every Friday, 1 p.m. or thereabouts. Next week's going to be an interesting conversation. In the meantime, you can find out more about the Institute at southwestpolicy.com. Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, today. Thanks for having me on today, Patrick. This is fun. Yeah, sounds good. Bye, everybody. Thank you.